You had mentioned in a message that you had an idea for today's show.
Oh yeah. Considering that the Red Ice interview is going live today, I thought that it wouldn't have to dominate the whole show, but to have a segment kind of spotlighting certain episodes in the archives that either are a good starting point, are a particular favorite of yours or mine, or anything that you wanted to comment to sort of give anyone who found their way over here from Red Ice a sort of, I don't know, a walkthrough or a guide to the 52 episodes already in the can.
Yeah, that might be an interesting idea. I would have probably have gone through it a bit more before the show,
Yeah,
but
I had definitely thought I either was planning on talking to you and didn't, or I thought Alan was gonna discuss it with you. But
it's simple enough, though.
it seems simple enough.
Yeah. Let's see here. Wow. It's interesting to represent our conversations visually, because as I go through these and I see the visual and all the things involved, I remember the conversation then. It's kind of, I don't
Yeah.
even have to read the side panel. All I need is to look at the pictures. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's a beautiful library in that regard. To have it all just sort of. Yeah, it's stunning work by Alan.
True.
Every image seems to have its own distinct personality, which just floors me.
Well, I would recommend the Jan Irving episode. I'm just kidding.
Well, it, and
I wouldn't.
oddly enough, I would say it's a pretty damn good it's pretty damn good illustration of what the show is all about. It's for a lot of people who I think read about a lot of these topics and would end up at thesyncbook.com or would end up finding out about the show Always Record or 42 Minutes. Or synchronize. I think it illustrates really well that it's a more personal side to the internet in the sense that you can read a hell of a lot of content by certain writers out there, but to get to hear them speak in a more conversational manner without very many restraints, it doesn't have to enhance or take away from any of the content. It just adds a new dimension to it. I think it makes the internet a little bit warmer, you know?
Yeah,
So.
I really liked I like a lot of these episodes, obviously, but I like when M Mark LeClaire was on talking with the mirror ball, kind of looking over his chapter a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that episode a lot, and in fact, I would like to have Mark on a lot more because I think he's great, and I like what he contributes to it, and he's good. Conversationally, it leaves for very interesting radio.
Yeah, and I think that you really can find, like episode 4, I think is the first episode we had Mark on with us, and I think that's a pretty, that was a pretty long episode. But I think you'll find when you listen to that episode, I think Mark would even say this himself that. I think he, over the course of just that episode, which is probably like 3.5 hours long, you can kind of hear how he adjusts to the tone of the show.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And then that was the thing, is that the second time he went on, it was kind of a different, he kind of had more wherewithal of what we were doing. 'Cause I think, and there's just this, people are used to being interviewed, and that show feels more like an interview with him, which is fine. But we're kind of having a conversation. And so the next time he comes on, it's more of a actual conversation. Really?
Yeah, the baton is definitely passed around a lot more, and without any kind of pressure or design, it just sort of organically moves around the room, which is amazing, really. Like, some of the episodes are packed with different, very, bright thinking people, and I don't know. I'm imagining. I wonder what it's like for a listener to hear like six people in the room going on about this stuff. I don't know where else you'll find that. That might be because it might not be any good. I don't know. It might be so niche that it's just not a very suggested formula. But it's not like we do that all the time. So I really enjoy those episodes when you have like six or seven people in the room.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, it's like a party, and people will be having conversation. You gotta, and you can't always keep track of what everyone's saying all at once, because it's kind of like a flood of information, and people are talking, just, but what you do catch is cool. And then that means that if you listen to it again, you'll probably catch things that you didn't before, and so that's okay.
Hey, look at this. 9/11/2012, episode 17. Six different guests: Douglas Bowles, Jason Barrera, Justin Morgan, Violator Hellspawn, John Fell Ryan, Maya Alexis, and us three guys. That's a full room.
Shit. That's funny.
So yeah, so if you're for this is the first time checking out Always Record and what we do here, 52 episodes in the archives. I think there's something for everybody in there, and I don't. There's no reason to start from episode one and go all the way through 52. I don't even know if that. I would even suggest that. But
There's people who have.
there are people who have. But I don't know. I think if I hadn't been a part of it and I had found it, I would have felt very, very excited to dig into all this stuff. So I hope anyone out there who's new checks it out.
I'd recommend, in particular, our episode where we go over the film Head, the Monkees film, and view it over the film Head, which is available for instant streaming. So we've had somebody do that recently, in response to that particular episode, and I thought that that was just great that he did that.
Yeah, no, that's good to hear. And if you're out there, it's episode number five, and if you start part two, you'll hear a 1, 2, 3 countdown, and that is starting the movie. I think we all streamed it from YouTube, right? So that starts with the live YouTube streaming. We should probably
Let include the directions on the
or sync that up to the DVD. Just say, hey, at this certain minute is when. Just time it up with a certain scene and just figure it out so anyone with the DVD could probably do that. I'd like to probably do that again sometime with a different film.
Yeah, no, I'm into that. I like that idea a lot. I think we can do it with a lot of different
You know,
good
there's a
things.
director out there. I think it's the guy who did Looper. Ryan, I can't think of his last name right now. But do you know for the film before Looper, and I think even maybe for Looper, he recorded a commentary track that you could take into the movie theater? And I'm surprised that that wasn't as advertised, or that was just, like a rumor that never really happened. But I'm pretty sure it did happen.
So he did a commentary. So before any DVD extras come out, you could download a commentary and listen to it on headphones while you're watching a film in the theater. That's funny.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, Alan's not quite here yet, and Did you want to actually have clips from these shows when we drop this episode, or what were you thinking?
I just really wanted to just for however long we felt like the conversation needed to be, just sort of open up this show with what we were just doing, just for the new listener.
Oh, I love this. I love the episode six, the splitting the Adam Codmon episode. Oh, this
Yeah,
was,
no, that was you
you
and
didn't make this one, but this was a good episode.
No, that was
There's
I
actually one of my favorite episodes was actually something that you never put up, which was just you and me. In fact, I think it was one of our first just you and me episodes, actually. But that one never made it.
It's in the vault, Dave.
Is it? Do you still have it?
I think I do.
Yeah, you should post that at some point. I like that. That was fun. That was like you were kind of interviewing me a little bit,
Yeah, no,
and
yeah, that
obviously
was
contributing your ideas. That's kind of a good show, actually. But it was just because I think we didn't expect it to go that way necessarily, and it did. I didn't know what that episode was going to be. Mr. Cloud.
MK Ultrasound.
How's it going?
Doing good.
Do you know if Alan's around or he's just.
I'm expecting Alan. I just don't know what time.
All right. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty rattled from Raging Bull.
You've been drinking Raging Bull?
The movie. I hadn't seen it in years, and I watched the movie Raging Bull last night.
Is that with Sylvester Stallone?
I don't know if he tried out for the movie, but it was Robert De Niro.
Oh, I'm not remembering it.
It's Scorsese's black and white boxing picture from 1980.
Oh.
And sounded like a passion project from De Niro, who really wanted to make this film, and a lot of people credit De Niro's passion for the project for saving Scorsese's life. Because Scorsese in 78 had hit rock bottom with a cocaine overdose and was in the hospital and was basically on his way out of the film industry. And the film is unreal.
Yeah,
It's.
I can't believe I've never seen this.
Yeah.
Really, I can remember.
Yeah, definitely put that on the list. But it's one of those movies that, I saw probably as a teenager and knew that it was one of the great, great films and left going, okay, I know it's supposed to be great. I don't think it's great. I'm going to have to figure this one out eventually. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks last night. So, highest recommendation for Raging Bull.
He has a quote at the end of the film from the New Testament.
Yeah.
So for the second time, the Pharisees summoned the man who had been blind and said, "Speak the truth before God. We know this man is a sinner." "Whether or not he is a sinner, I do not know," the man replied. "All I know is this: once I was blind, and now I can see." And it's because Scorsese was dedicating the film to this man who died during its filming. Or it's Scorsese's film professor.
Yeah, a
Hang
Magoonian or something.
Ma Manoogian, yeah, something like
Yeah.
that. Wow. Any sync value?
Well, it's curious that when De Niro won for Best Actor, Jake LaMotta was in the audience, and when Sissy Spacek won for Coal Miner's Daughter the same night, Loretta Lynn was also in the audience. So it was this weird occasion when The real life characters were in the audience when the cinematic actor and actress won awards for best actor and actress. So some twinning going on there. But there was also one other curious little thing.
Joe Pesci's in it with Robert De Niro, so that's a repeating pair. Yeah, the complimentary.
And they had to talk Pesci into doing the film. He was also considering getting out of the movie business and focusing strictly on his entertainment musical act with his friend. So, pretty good film for everybody involved. Put them on the right path, that's for sure.
We started to watch a children's movie that was like, it wasn't Pixar. I don't know if it was Disney, but it was like fucking Jack Frost and the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and like all of these characters like dealing with the man on the moon and the boogeyman. And it was a Rise of the Guardians. It's a children's movie and it's pretty bad, but the symbolism through, I was like, I didn't want to turn it off initially because I was like, oh, but the symbolism is so interesting. And I could see what they were doing, where every one of those characters was representing a different like continent of the world or a different nation. And so you could hear it in their accents. Like each one would have a different world accent. And in the headquarters, it was totally Masonic, and the floors all said G. So it was like G all around, and they had banners of G everywhere. And I was like, "What the fuck is G for?" And then my friend said, "I think it's a C for claws." And I was like, "No, but you can see it's a G, and it's Guardians is what the G was for." And I thought it was really interesting that you could take it that they're literally like that the guardians of the world are. It was as if the secret societies were like guarding the world from various outside forces. And so immediately for me, I'm looking at it, and the boogeyman, he has the other name in the film is Pitch Black. And he's literally like, so there's the character of the Sandman, who's always nodding off. He looks like a heroin addict. And then the boogeyman is literally like black sand, or even like black. It's psychedelic the way it moves. Very psychedelic movie, just with the way that it's animated. But I thought it was an interesting thing that it seemed like they were pushing, was that these characters that ever, the holiday characters were like secret society representatives from around the world.
I like that.
I mean, that's literally what it was. I mean, when you're watching it, it's if you're, it's pretty obvious. But then I thought it was interesting that the Easter Bunny is a jackrabbit, and then he's interacting with Jack Frost, and just like Jack Frost kept on reminding me of Jack in The Shining when he freezes in the snow at the end. And then for it to be that Jack Frost it was being communicated that he's like, I'm not a guardian, I'm not one of you guys. But then it was the man on the moon who told everybody else that he was actually a guardian. And so I don't know, I was kind of like, I don't know, I should have actually finished it, but it was actually more for the sake of the people I was watching it with, that they weren't digging on the they're not as inclined to look at the symbolism side as much. They were just like, we're watching a kids movie about
Having a laugh at the Easter Bunny and
It's like, oh, it's the Easter Bunny. I'm like, I could see kids getting excited over this because they're like, whoa, the Easter Bunny's interacting with Santa Claus and the boogeyman. This is crazy.
they're breaking
These
all
are
the
all different.
rules. Everyone's
Right.
involved. It's like an episode
Right.
of Always Record, man.
But it had a theosophical edge, being that it was like all the different schools coming together. So what? And it's
Okay, I see that, yeah.
And so, and then there's an, also an aspect of like, if you look at like the idea of the new secular order being one of everything all at once. So, like, basically the nations coming together, which is the vision of like the Lucis Trust, right? Is like, that's the purpose of the United Nations, is literally not to simply be a mediator between nations, but to get to the point where we're actually all one entity. Which on one level is crucial because there'll be endless wars until that happens, and on another level is detrimental because most likely it'll be one nation or a couple nations basically bullying the rest of the world and making them conform to its own ideals, which may or not be in their best interest and most likely wouldn't be. But that seemed to be what they were portraying, was a kind of a coming together of all the nations for a common cause, which in this case is defeating the boogeyman. Which is great if you think about the fact that it's imaginary and they're imaginary, and that it's actually an imaginary cause at that point. And so it's kind of insane, which is awesome to look at it through that lens if you're watching this film.
You know, I'm thinking of Jack Frost, and I immediately think of The Invisibles. Were you a fan of that comic?
I didn't really get into the comic, but I did see the movie with Sean Connery, right? Wasn't he?
Oh, wow. I don't think that there was ever a movie of The Invisibles.
Oh, The Invisibles. Oh, I thought you were talking about
The Invincibles, maybe?
no, there was, I'm thinking League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Okay.
But that wasn't even Sean Connery anyway. I don't remember. Was it? I don't know. Fuck, I'm terrible. I can't remember these things. But anyways, yeah, what was the deal with the Invisibles?
Was the Grant Morrison hypersigil comic that has some credibility in his claim that the Wachowski brothers were fans of the comic, were reading the comic, were seen to have the comic while they were making the original Matrix. But in the comic, Jack Frost is a young kid who gets initiated and becomes a part of the Invisibles, which are this team of shamanic, supermen, but really they're human beings. I'm not going to do a good job of distilling the Invisibles into, a little synopsis, but basically, Morrison wrote himself into the comic, and it's really just, Crowley's Aha poem? It's like this is Grant Morrison's Aha poem, but in a graphic novel or in a comic. It's a comic book. It's not a graphic novel. In a comic book, and it's just, the whole thing, putting it all in there. And I think he did the comic for like 5 years, maybe. But it's loaded. I mean, it's much like Cosmic Trigger is a roadmap to so many different books, movies, ways of thinking. That's what this sort of accomplished, I think. It's just if you go into the Invisibles, you're not going to come out the same person, and your bookshelves are should be increasing because of it. It should just point you in so many different directions. But in that, it's sort of like it looks like Jack Frost is the one who's being recruited or the one who's being illuminated in this movie of Rise of the Guardians. He like finds out about the Guardians, is it?
Well, he's an outcast.
Okay.
And so there is like Kabbalistically, I mean, this is what I was just talking about in 42 minutes, but like that I've been looking at the Chetzonim and the Klipot a lot. And so considering that the boogeyman in this case is like completely the Klipot, because he's darkness, he's literally pitch black, and he's from the outside, and they don't want him fucking with their what there is their organized system, and so he's disorganizing it, right? So he's stealing teeth from the tooth fairy, right? And like are making it so the kids never get their teeth taken or something, I don't know, but he's messing with their order. And so Jack Frost is looked at as chaos in this film, like that he isn't a guardian because he's not. I mean, they don't look at him like the same way that they do the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus. They're like, no, he just spreads the snow around. And so I was really like, I don't know, I was digging on, I can't help it, but I think of The Shining, and then obviously the waning and waxing of the moon, like relating Room 237 to the moon room, and kind of like that this boogeyman is like the dark side of the moon, which Jack Frost is the light side of. So it was like there were two sides of the same thing. So like Hatsune literally means the outside ones. And so they're both cliphotic, yet one is so like, but then at the same time, it's like there's no dark side of the moon really. As a matter of fact, it's all dark because they're mutually interdependent. And so they're two sides of the same thing. But you could just as easily say there's no, that it's all bright, or that it's all whatever. It could go either way. Like it's all Jack Frost or it's all the boogeyman. But because they're both appearances, and that's the whole point. And that's why I was expressing I've had reluctance to even studying the cliphotic tree, because I know from the get-go that you're talking about something that's only imitating a higher order. It's not an order. It's got different rules because it has to meet it to a certain degree, but it's malleable. Whereas the other one is not malleable in the same way. It's malleable in terms of how you interpret it, but your interpretation itself is cliphotic. So, because it's knowledge, and knowledge, the clipo stem out of da'at, or they're connected to da'at. And so I don't know. I thought that was kind of, I was kind of tripping out on that, on the symbolism there.
Wouldn't you say just watching network television is a good way to study the cliphotic tree?
Excuse me?
Watching network television is a good way to study the cliphotic tree?
Well, yeah, but I mean, yes, and it's all the clipo in varying degrees. So I guess the idea would be that the deeper that you go into, like, basically layers of ego, ego not in the sense of like of pure I sense of like being alive, but ego in the sense of like the structure, and getting to kind of like the trauma that exists within our being. So like as we're developing, we're projecting our matrix as a coping mechanism. And so to go into deeper levels of trauma is to basically unravel the clipo, which are like literally lodged in the system. So they're like parasitic in that sense, but then they're also ruling the perceptions, much like what we were discussing about the cats being the cause of schizophrenia. That theory in Paris that people have house cats, and that the house cats have a parasite, that it's a mutual, it's like a ongoing issue or cycle that has to do with the rats. So the rats with their urine, and they have this whole thing, and so they have this like the rats are like seeking out their urine. There's something in the urine that's due to this parasite. Super gross and weird, but it's just this idea that like that we're our perceptions are being influenced by these intelligences, and so that are literally from the outside. So in order to kind of cleanse oneself or purify oneself of them is literally to pull them out from where they're lodged. And so network television could work that way if you look at network television as a reflection of that phenomenon. So, or that even if it's taking advantage or playing on that phenomenon, kind of like the Edward Bernaysian side of culture is very much taking advantage of this thing that we have in place, right? It's like, oh, okay, so you're identified with thought form. Well, then here, we'll give you everything that could ever want in order to maintain its own structure, or to project structure.
You know, to take the metaphor of tilling the soil that you mentioned on 42 Minutes the other day, I guess network television is sort of like a field that has not been, you know how you have to recycle fields, or you have to put them in a, you can't keep planting on the same area field, you have to let it go fallow or something for a season, or else you just strip the earth of all its minerals and you just can't grow on it anymore.
Yeah, it's also the same as separating the wheat from the chaff because you have to let it all grow together before you'll destroy the crop if you try and do it otherwise.
So you really can't, if you till the soil of network television, you're not going to really find anything in there. It's a barren wasteland for a reason. It's just meant to be taken on a surface level, digested, and just forgotten about, seemingly.
Right. I mean, I would say that if you were, I mean, ultimately, this is kind of the Kantian kind of idea, right? Is that if there's an order, then you should be able to see that order anywhere. If you know how to look and if you look deeply enough, my argument would be that there's the order that is the underlying order that actually exists behind things. That's literally part the dynamics of its very structure and its formation, and then there's the imitative order that, if you go deeply enough into, you find that it's hollow. It's literally a hologram, right?
Yeah.
So there's always and but it's good to do that, to go into it and discover that, and that's the value of it, is to come out the other side and see that it. You know, you can twist back and forth and all around through it, and that it's actually something, like I said, that's malleable. So you're not, it's not a rigid structure. Whereas, you know, the underlying structure, it wouldn't be appropriate to call rigid. It's, you know, it's in place. And it's been in place since forever because, in order for things to expand in space, they need to divide. In order to divide, they need to follow a certain set of dynamics. And those dynamics are inherent in their structure. And that's the meaning of tetragrammaton, right? But then the clathodic tree is literally a flipped, it's a mirror of tetragrammaton that's like the mirror in the Matrix. If he goes to touch the mirror, it's like liquefied. He's like, what the fuck? And like, that's not, you know, it's because it's an appearance that's held in place. So it's projected into place, and we hold it there through like our tensions and, you know, well, the two sides of it, right? So like, if somebody compliments you and you feel expanded and you're like, oh, that feels good, you know, it's because it's affirming the structure that we're projecting. And then if they insult you and you have to protect it and you clench up, then that is, you know, threatening the structure that you're projecting. Both are equally dysfunctional, but we usually see the one where it's getting insulted and we experience fear of, you know, that being found out within ourselves because we're having to believe in it in order to give it its reality. So we experience that as dysfunctional when really they both are. It's important to realize that. It's like the Morrison line, I touched her thigh and death smiled. It's like you know, the one appearance where you're like, ooh, or like Jack in Room 237 when he sees the beautiful woman, he's like, hey, and then she's all of a sudden this grotesque thing. It's because both are appearances, and so they're both equally dysfunctional in that way. But he wouldn't have seen the first one as dysfunctional. He's like, oh, that's fucking where this is where it's at, you know.
Yeah, Jack was very happy for a while in room 237.
For a good minute, I'm very happy. But there's nothing in that room. That's the whole point. The room is empty. There's not a goddamn thing in there.
Not a goddamn thing in room 237. So, to study the Clefotic tree, there are books written solely on the subject, or are they sort of like addendums to books on the tree?
A lot of the books that are just on the subject, at least in my observation from friends who I've had who have studied that, is they're like they're weird. They're like generally like, and they're treating that tree as if it were the tree of life, through like homage to that tree. And those aren't very good books. They don't have a very deep understanding of that. I mean, I'm reading commentary on the Zohar that's at in certain sections gets very focused on the clephotic tree, but it doesn't treat it the same way. It doesn't treat it the same way that the tree of life is treated because it's insane. Whereas like even if you're interpreting the tree of life, yeah, that's insane because your interpretation is literally clephotic. So, but it's expressing that the Ot is the universe as we know it. So like, you know, like when REM is like, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine, it's not the end of the world. It's just the world that we that we're taking in on an appearance level. It's not the actual end of the world. It's just
Don't you kind of see someone like Anton LaVey as like a clephotic clown who knows he's a clephotic clown?
yeah. I mean, he absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's his whole joke. And I mean, everybody's like, I didn't realize the full degree of like the people that were into this. And because I didn't, I when I was studying the Crowley, I never bothered with Kenneth Grant, and I never bothered with the evolution of Thelema. And now I come to realize that that's its entire focus now, for the most part. It's a big part of its focus, unless if you're just looking at Crowley and his own works, but what who's contributing to it now? What is their focus? It's from my observation. I mean, someone like Kevin Halcott, who's more familiar, might have more to say on this because I'm not involved. But from what I gathered, from what I've looked at with Kenneth Grant, is it's like that's a major part of it. And so I wonder about the Beatles then, because when the Beatles jump in, they're not just looking at Crowley, obviously. They're looking at what it is now, what is the society. And so that makes me like feel like, well, maybe that's what they're like, if that's their focus or a big part of their focus, because that's why they're into playing their records backwards, you know. I mean, whether or not we're talking about, you know, subliminal backwards messages being implanted, which I feel are there, or not, if someone's skeptical on that, the fact is you have Strawberry Fields as a back is a backwards beat, you know, in the same way that like Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced, is a backwards beat. And it's like, you know, it sounds good, you know, but I mean, I wonder where what they're communicating with that, you know. It seems like they're hip to it, you know.
Two things. I think that, the back masked vocals are really just like the Easter eggs on DVDs, right? It was just a manipulation of the media in a interesting way to get people to talk about the record in a more poetic, romantic way, And plus it divided people, those who get the joke, those who don't get the joke. You get the whole Crowley and Onion thing going on. But the other thing is that the real first book I read about Aleister Crowley was Kenneth Grant's Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God. I picked it up at the occult bookstore in Wicker Park in Chicago. I mean, that's literally what it was called, the occult bookstore. And I got this book, and that was one of my first real introductions into the whole Crowley universe, and it was a fairly informative book, and a lot of the scholar, like the history is all there, but when Kenneth Grant goes into his own thing, it was just like there were parts of the book that I really resonated with, and then there were these parts that I didn't even go back to read. And I would go back to it, it just would throw me off. It was just like the book was comprised of two different streams of thought, There was this guy Crowley, and then Kenneth Grant sort of trying to absorb Crowley into himself and to sort of equate himself with it. And, I don't know if I'm right or wrong or if that even matters, but, Kenneth Grant seems to really want to go odd places. That's basically what I got out of it. I wish I could put it in more technical terminology.
He's doing the same thing that Crowley did, and
Yeah, not as well.
And just well, it's yeah, it's true, not as well. But it's not just a matter of that. So that was my issue too. I mean, I totally felt that initially because I was seeing that a lot of his basic gematria seems questionable, and just different things like he's pushing for something that he it seems like he wants it to be this way, and so he's kind of like manipulating things to make it that way in certain cases, but in certain other cases. It's like he'll have he's creative and he'll have ideas that are just very like an interesting take. I appreciate his ideas around Lom mainly, and I'm not very familiar with Kenneth Grant. And I'm like, if you want to own many of the Kenneth Grant books, it's like it's hard to find one for under $500, and it's because they're rare, and I could understand that. And they're in demand, and something's worth as much as someone's willing to pay, and that's the way it goes. But I'm really I want to find a PDF of his particular he has a book specifically on lamb, however you want to say it,
Really?
I guess lamb. And I'd be interested to read it. And then the other one is the seventh arch, or the ninth arch, excuse me. And I would just like to look at that and relate it to Revolution number 9 and the ninth gate of Polanski's and just kind of meditate on that whole deal. Like, that's the thing, like, with synchronicity is that you'll see that something could very well be insightful for something else. And a set of, it's like a combination to a lock. And you're like, okay, well, there's these pieces. And if I want to open up this safe, then I have to basically bring all of these different components together, and in that is it's like I'll be able to open the priest hole, you know, and
Yeah,
hopefully rock.
I agree completely. 'Cause I was looking for when I was watching Raging Bull, I watched it last night with music, and I watched it this morning traditionally with its regular sound, and I couldn't find an album that could sync with it. Just whatever I was putting together wasn't working, but I never had like an inspired decision behind it. I was just kind of throwing paint on the wall, you know. Just to see if anything interesting would happen. I mean, it's always interesting to view a great director's work visually without any distractions. So that was all. That can always be an exciting part of the process. But you know, it's just that intuitive resonance where you go, "This works" or "This isn't working," and I just haven't found anything that works with that movie. I guess. With Kenneth Grant, I've never found anything in my life that made me say, "Oh, I got to read more Kenneth Grant." I read Kenneth Grant more from a curiosity standpoint, you know. I think he's an interesting character. I'd like to learn more about him, but I know I got pretty excited when I found the PDF for Magical Revival online and was pleasantly surprised, pleasantly not even surprised. I was happy to know that I'm glad I didn't spend the $300 to buy it. You know, because what the contents of which I found in that PDF weren't really that enlightening, or it didn't really attract me very much.
And it's also what people do with it, and what they're getting out of it is something else. What you're also looking for is basically Crowley, so you might as well just read Crowley, is what I'm the way I'm hearing that, which is perfectly understandable. And I'm just interested in who is looking at this guy and how did they portray it? And so, like, I see what he has to say, and I see Strawberry Fields. And it's weird. And but that's the way I feel about it so far. I mean, I need to look into it more, but I mean, he hasn't been my focus. And so I'm like, well, maybe if I offered a little bit more attention there, just from the few things that I've come across, I'm like, huh, that's interesting. Lom is literally the Eggman as far as he's concerned. And so, like, you know, and then Salvador Dali's Eggman is Lom as well. Like what that's communicating of the archetypal man emerging from this egg. And if you look at the clipote as the shell being the egg that's surrounding the tree, and then you consider that the Orphic egg is literally the green line is knowledge. And this is what I'm looking at in Ramak's commentary on the Zohar is he's relating that what the tree of knowledge is in his eyes is literally this thing that gets set into motion that's passed knowledge from person to person that is literally cliphotic. So that the serpent that's winding around the Orphic egg is literally a line of knowledge that's encircling the planet and it's spread throughout the planet. So it starts somewhere, whatever, Aiden, and from there it just you have a place where the four rivers connect, right? So it's a central place and probably Africa or something. But then the thing just like engulfs the planet and then we're all ruled by this perception that is the result of projection and belief. And so and it's the beginning of man in the first place. It's our roots. From our very roots is this thing. And so you could also look at a particular human's being a human being's lifespan as a microcosm of the same phenomenon because we're literally engulfed in the serpent that is not because and then there's the thing is that there's two serpents just like there this there's a chapter in Morals and Dogma Albert Pike that goes into this idea of the brazen serpent it's a grade in Freemasonry and so but that you have the serpent on the pole from Numbers 21 that is the healing serpent which is a real thing it's like Kundalini right and then you have this which is generally repressed and then you have the serpent that's like basically the serpent that's keeping that from doing its real work and that's like oh Alan says sorry just woke up well he's welcome to come on at his own pace because he's the sink pimp. But I don't know. I've really been tripping out on that whole notion a lot. And so to look at Lom as the Eggman that is the shell of our perception is that he's holding our perception in place gives credence to the idea that what the Book of the Law is meant to be is that every 2,000 years there's a new law that gets presented. So you have the Old Testament, then you have the New Testament, and then his ambition is to project the new law, which is do what thou wilt. And so what are we moving towards? Driver, where are you taking us? I don't know.
Yeah,
I've interesting.
that's a lot to process there.
Also, the fact that you have the Samech Mem or Samael, however they say it, you're not supposed to say it. That's why I don't know how to pronounce it. But then that and then Lilith, the Lamed, are looked at as that Lilith is literally riding Samael. So who is a serpent? He is a snake and she's riding him, is actually the symbolism in Kabbalah. And so, and then there was taken over the head of the tree as the supernal triad of the dying tree or the reverse tree, the mirrored tree. And so I thought that that was really kind of interesting of just like, ride the snake, it's literally she's riding the snake. And then it can't help but bring to my mind Apep of the Egyptians who follows the celestial boat through the underworld to try and keep Osiris from being re-risen, right? From being resurrected in the underworld. Kind of interesting.
Do we have an Alan Green? He might be
You
getting his.
do.
Hey.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
Now the party can start.
What's going on, guys? I'm sorry that I'm so late here, but
It's been a
yeah,
busy week.
after the this week has kind of kicked my ass, and I just crashed at some point last night.
you're supposed to just show up on the show with a bunch of hookers and blow and just be like, okay, I'm ready for the gig. People are...
Well, right, what I was supposed to do was keep going all night and then just be here, which I think I did that like 2 weeks ago. But you know, I know you're kidding, but like my type of partying, staying up all night doing coding for websites and
you do,
you know, fun stuff like I'm a you can't handle my kind of partying. It's intense.
Yeah, you're a code head.
Oh yeah. So I kind of just came in here in the last few minutes, heard you talk about APEP in the underworld here and Samael and Lilith.
Yeah.
What's
I watched part of a film called Rise of the Guardians, and I couldn't help.
Oh, the owl movie?
No, that's the Guardians, but then I thought this was going to be an owl movie, but this is like looking at all of the holiday characters like Santa Claus and Easter Bunny and all of them, that they're actually like a secret society that's like protecting the world. And so it's a terrible movie. It's a kid's movie, but the symbolism was all there. And so the character Jack Frost is in communication with the man on the moon, and he has to stop with the rest of the Guardians, the boogeyman, who's literally called Pitch Black. But I just love the archetypes because, first of all, the headquarters of the Guardians, it's like, it looks like a Masonic hall. I mean, there's no checkered floor, but everything else looks like a Masonic hall. It's just got that feel, right? And so, but there's G's everywhere. It's like for Guardians. And it was taking me a second to even realize what the G was for. I'm like, why is there G's everywhere? What the fuck? And so it was just really kind of interesting that every character represents a different nation of the world or a different continent. And so everyone has a different accent, but then they're all there with a common cause. And they're like, you know, they're the guardians of the planet or whatever. But I like the idea that Jack Frost is in connection with the moon. Like he's the bright side of the moon. And then Boogeyman is the dark side of the moon. And so the way that was playing out in the thing, and that also like that there's this kind of resonant connection between the Boogeyman and the Sandman in the thing. So the Sandman's always nodding out and he's like a nod, right? And then the Boogeyman is like, you know, making everyone have bad dreams. So he's like, he's connect. It's just this whole weird thing. And then I was also remembering the comic book Sandman, which was just genius comic. Bill is mentioning the Invisibles, which now that I'm looking at the covers, I'm like, I've seen those around, but I've never looked at it. In fact, I'm looking at an image right now that is totally like this kind of what do you call it? A flapper of the 20s women. Do you call it? I think they call them flappers. I forget, but she's basically in the position of Shiva in front of Metatron's representation. Metatron's spinning hex here with the circles. And so I'm like, oh, that's really kind of an interesting overt cover. And so Bill was saying that this was an influence on the Matrix, apparently, that they...
Yeah, I mean, Grant Morrison, you know, now he's sort of like a more, you know, younger psychedelic version of Alan Moore, whereas he took comics to be a magic art form. And Grant Morrison talks about sigil magic and using comics as sigil magic, whereas he talks about what he did with the Invisibles is sort of tried, he put himself in there as a character and tried to make other characters that he'd want to meet or things that he'd want to happen to him in real life. And then when that started to happen, the bad shit came with the good shit.
Right.
And
well, that was the whole point of a big part of our discussion, was the flip side coming with the bright side. So if you want the moon, you get the whole moon, right? So
absolutely.
So Jack in Room
237. Absolutely.
He's seeing the bright side of the moon when he was walking up to that woman, and then, oh, what do you know? It's got this other side to it, and oh, I want that, but we don't recognize. We see the negative side is dysfunctional, but we don't see the positive side. But you're looking at a magnet, and so both come together all the time, and that's a really very important thing when you're dealing with magic. And so I guess that was what was trying to be conveyed with LSD, not just being only a bright side thing. And so there was kind of this pushed idea of the dark side of
well, it. It's funny because I had this, I'm having this conversation, not just with you guys, but this is kind of carried over, this theme is carried over into a lot, almost everything for me lately. Even a few nights ago, so we've had the Vitamix conversation, not always record, but a few nights ago, my wife was putting something in the Vitamix and she was taking stuff out. And she cut like a lemon and she was pulling the seeds out. And I was like, why? I was like, you can put the seeds in there. And she's like, yeah, but you don't have to. And I was like, so I was saying, I thought part of the idea of this was that you're eating the entire food. You know, it's like whole foods, not the supermarket chain. But the idea of a whole foods diet being that you're really trying to eat all parts of the food. And like, yeah, there's this herbalist and author, Rosemary Gladstar, who really likes. So she was reading this woman, Rosemary's. So it was funny, Rosemary, I know. But when we were going through our whole Rosemary kick is when Melissa got into this woman's work, and I was like, oh, it's funny, we're both syncing with Rosemary. But anyway, Gladstar, Rosemary Gladstar, right? So she's like the good, the Rosemary with the positive aspect. Oh, by the way, Rosemary Gladstar, this herbalist, in all her video presentations and everything, she wears a crescent moon necklace. So it's like just too funny. But okay, so she says, so when I'm having this conversation, she goes, yeah, you can leave some stuff out of the Vitamix. Rosemary makes this comment that it's okay to give some things up to the compost goddess or something like that, like just a sort of funny expression. You know, like it's all right to give some of it back, right? Put some of it back in the earth. And we start talking about what would a compost goddess be. And I was saying, well, you know, a compost goddess isn't just she embodies both the green life, you know, so she would be something that's beautiful and re-energizing everything, but she'd also be, you know, maggots and rotting and death and all this stuff. So I was picturing the Room 237 scene where it's both the beautiful young woman and the rotting corpse. You know, I hope you understand. I don't mean this like literally like a post goddess, but for all intents and purposes, what, you know, we were trying to sort of imagine what such a thing would be. And I'm like, I kept going back to the woman in Room 237, and not in a bad way, but in a, like, this is a necessary aspect of life.
Right.
You get rebirth without death.
Yeah. I mean, if you take just a walk in the forest, you see that everything's growing out of things that are dying. Like, it's just, that's what it is. And it's just always like that. So I think that that's, people want to acknowledge that, but it's also, if you go deep enough into that acknowledgement, it is kind of difficult territory, because that's like the key to ultimate rationalization. And I mean, that's like what Charles Manson told the family. It was like, you can't take away from the all and you can't add to the all. It's like a basic fundamental hermetic principle, yet at the same time, it's used all over the place for people rationalizing murder. And so that's difficult, because you want people to transcend the duality, but at the same time, you don't want them to go so far with that. And like, there's this kind of assumption that gets presented in different, especially like new agey kind of spirituality, where they're like, if you transcend the opposites, it's all love. and I don't.
Right. It's like it doesn't. Yeah. If you go all the way to the love, then you're in an opposite.
The idea is,
right?
Okay. So we have to qualify what we're saying now, because you could say that there's a love that has no opposite.
Unconditional love. Absolutely. Absolutely. But that means in that all encompassing love, it means you embrace the rotting corpse in the bathtub of room 237.
Completely. Absolutely. And at the same time, there's the, you know, you do no other harm than the inevitable harm that's already being done. Like, you'd be so, ultimately, I guess this is the idea, is that you'd be so sensitive to everything that's taking place. You see that life feeds on life, feeds on life, feeds on life. For eternity, in order for something to exist, something else has to die, and it's just the way it is. But simultaneously, there's nothing extra that's put on top of that. So it's like Zen being life with nothing added. You're not adding any excess karma to the karma that's already happening on its own. And so in doing that, the samskaras, or the seeds or the tendencies that have been perpetuated, start to dissipate. And so, I mean, that's a Buddhist idea as well as a Hindu idea, is that, you know, our latent tendencies that are kind of playing out and influencing our actions have like a shelf life, so to speak. So if one is doing the real work, like that's what yoga does, is it breaks down what is held so tightly in place, right? But that means taking another step. So it's not like you get to Keter and you stop there. It's that you get to Keter and that's the beginning of the real work, which is the premise of the Matrix, and which is why I love the Lifehouse Matrix in that way, is because that's the Who's main point. That's what Tommy's about, you know, is that you get to this high point and then that's when the real work starts. Because then Tommy's sets up the organization to get everybody to do the thing, to have the vision. But then he has to have a further breakdown to take him to the heart before the
absolutely
real alchemy has occurred. And that's why it's the whole focus in that film. It's about the rose, is that it's emphasizing that you need to, the rose is literally the heart. And so you need to, the mediator between the mind and the hands has to be the heart. And so that's the whole point, is that, okay, you've reached a non-dual state. That's not enough. There's another.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, you know, but real quick, because I don't want to have to link to this in the show notes. The Invisibles cover you were talking about, if someone wanted to Google it, was Invisibles number 8 from Grant Morrison in Vertigo Comics. Just going to throw that out there if someone wanted to look at what you were talking about. So this idea of, you know, kind of getting to the top and having to almost start over, and even with the tree of life, is that above the tree is the roots of another tree, where the marriage of Keter and Malkuth, this idea of the, you know, bringing the Shekinah exile together and putting her back on the throne and all this sort of stuff. It reminds me, when I was a little kid, maybe this is why, in a weird sort of way, I was brainwashed to have a acceptance of this concept. When I was a little kid, my grandfather, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents when I was a little kid. My mom worked, so I would go to my grandparents' house. And my grandfather was in a wheelchair, so I, of course, have this concept of the Fisher King, or the lame king. It's really heavy in my childhood. But something that my grandfather, who very much represented this figure to me, as I look back on it, the symbolism is so intense. I could go on for 30 minutes. I'm not going to, but let's just say, I mean, the archetypes are blaringly obvious to me at this point in my life. Anyway, he used to sing this song to me, which went, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain. What do you think he saw?
Okay.
He saw another mountain, he saw another mountain, he saw another mountain. So what do you think he did? The bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain. What do you think he saw? he saw another mount, and it just went like that. Uh-huh. And, you know, this, I mean, to me, it's like, yeah, basically, you when you get to the top, you see there's more. And when you see there's more, what do? But keep fucking climbing.
Right. And I feel like that's the whole issue, is that there's organizations set up where people get to a point, and then they're kind of like, okay, now what can we control below us, rather than where can we keep going with this?
Right.
Becoming a true adept, they reach a certain level of adeptness, and then they turn back, and are, instead of being like, well, how do we save everybody? They're like, how do we enslave everybody? And they're looking at that from a non-dual perspective, which allows them to feel liberated, but at the same time is really their prison. It's just another level of prison rather than the prison.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But that also feels to me very resonant with the Tibetan idea of this kind of like malevolent deity that we exist within, often represented in Tibetan artwork, where you see this being that's encircling the whole world, right? That being is actually literally the ego, and it's the thing that's not continuing to allow it, it's that reaches a certain height, reaches a certain zenith, and then instead of continuing to do the real work, it turns around and it's like, ah! You know? Yeah. Because, I mean, I don't doubt for a second that there, I mean, I don't see how the echelon couldn't be doing real work to a degree. Like there's something happening there. Like, they're not, you know, I mean, I think that there's...
What it is ain't exactly clear.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, hold on a second.
Will it ever be clear?
You know, I was talking to somebody last night, a neighbor of mine, and they were kind of curious, like somehow got into conversation. They were like, so what are your, you know, because I stepped outside with a cigarette. I was just like, oh God, I've just been doing internet code, like, nonstop, and I'm bleary eyed, and I'm sorry if I didn't make sense, like, trying to have a conversation with me, and I'm like, bah, I can't look at the world anymore. And so she's like, well, it's, you're trying to kind of explain it. And I'm saying, well, there's all these different angles that people can come from with synchronicity, you know, whether it's an art form, it's a, you know, it's a science, it's a spirituality, or sort of all of the above, or, you know, just different personal things you can do, or if, you know, like you guys doing movie mashups, and it's like, well, this is playing with it, you know, making new art out of it, and all this sort of stuff. And she's like, well, you know, so do you feel like you know what this all means? And I'm like, no. I was like, I think I just reached a place where I'm okay not knowing what it means, or knowing that everyone's gonna tackle a different sort of chip off this Rubik's cube, and together we keep looking. And, you know, if we can find an answer, that's. But I feel more often than not we're raising really good questions, and I think that's. That's good for now. It's not that I would like an answer, but I don't know if I would trust an answer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was, I was reading yesterday in Crowley's Book of Thoth, where he's just basically talking about the tree, and he just makes the point that it will never be the same thing for any two people. And that it's like, if you're looking at an object, and you got more than one person in the room, you're, for one thing, obviously just seeing it from a different physical perspective, but that the way that you're interpreting that object is inevitably different from somebody else. So if you were to look at a star then in the sky, you'd say, we're looking at the same star, but even the slightest variation of where you're standing differs from where somebody else is standing, actually influences to some degree your relationship to that thing. Like,
are you telling me that American Tail lied to me as a child?
American,
when he said, you know, the little mouse story, the cartoon mouse
Holocaust story. Yeah.
Yeah. When he's like, well, at least we're looking at the same star. At least we're looking at the same moon. Even though we're spread out by this distance, at least we're looking at, we can look at the same thing, means we're not so far removed.
That's the whole point of the
But it's like you can't look at the moon.
right, but you are simultaneously, because that is there in relationship to you. And so like on a like that's the difference between the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. And that's the thing, is that like from your like energy wise, yeah, you're relating to like what you're how you're relating to that thing is completely different than how you are actually in relationship to that thing, because you in relationship to that thing is completely balanced in like in relationship to your neighbor. Like you're all like how we're all in relationship to the sun, there's an equal and balanced kind of compensation that's occurring with everything in relationship to the center. And the center is everywhere and the circumference is nowhere, but there's still dynamics to the thing, and those dynamics are very real. But then the way that we represent that to ourselves is inevitably removed from that. And so that's that's an extension of the vacuum. That's not the thing itself. That's the restrictive force. It's not even just the restrictive force opposed against it, because that in itself is an equal compensation. It's our restrictive and expansive force that we're.
Would you equate this with like signifier and signified, something like that? Like how we're, what it's always going to be representation in our mind.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's.
Like even the actual moon, excuse me, even the actual moon would only be a signifier because it's something like it's my concept of what that thing is and.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, and it's pulling the tides, and then something's very real is happening through that. I mean,
Yeah.
we're all experiencing that, you know. I mean, obviously women experience it on a whole other more overt level, but like we're being affected by this thing. And so, and then on top of that, there's something else being affected by it simultaneously that's like a whole other level. And like that's how I interpret the dark side of the moon, is that everything under the sun is in tune, meaning that that you have the tree of life, that everything is in complete balance, and that we're experiencing this imbalance because we're putting something on top of that through the power of our will and our imagination. And that imagination is like everywhere, everything. Like we're experiencing it all the fucking time, and it's literally, you know, Neo sticks his finger into the mirror and pulls it back, and it's like blah, 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 blah. Like that's our what's on top of the reality. It's a hallucination, pretty trippy.